Greet you in Jesus' name. And good evening and welcome. I was glad to see at least some of you men visited quite a while last night, so I guess it indicates I didn't totally wear you out yet, so hoping that's what that means. Try not to do that. I know a week can... I get to come to a different community and sort of be pampered all week while the rest of you try to do everyday life plus, right? So... be conscientious about that too. So thank you for what you have put into this. So for those of you, there's still a box back there. I peeked in a little bit, best I could. Didn't see much in it, so I'd sure like your help with that. Also want to thank those that gave me some suggestions or direction last night and today. I enjoyed my time visiting school. I was glad to have devotions for them, but it was really fun to sit in the classrooms and see children learn things, even long division, right? I think that was maybe fourth grade. They weren't quite sure about it, whichever grade it was. So anyways. And also I enjoyed my time with the framing crew, so it's always interesting to see others work. So I'd warned you school children that you were going to get to help me preach one of these evenings a little bit, right? You were fairly quiet and mild this morning. I think children got more energy than the ones that were on the playground. You had quite a bit, so don't be scared. You know, I'm not going to bite you. So what did we talk about this morning? Any one of you school children want to tell the rest of them what we talked about? I told you quite a while ago I'm not a very good artist, so let's just put a sort of fish up here. How's that? I think maybe I can go like this. We'll give this fish a mouth and an eye up here. What do we say about fish? You don't have to raise your hand necessarily. I mean, it's fine if you do. I'll try to see it. But did you learn anything about fish? Did you know everything I told you already? One thing I ask you, just to help you, is I ask you why in the world a fish thinks this looks like food, didn't I? This here thing. I got my string wrapped around. Do you remember why does a fish bite on something like this? Remember? You'd think if he'd look close enough, he could see the hook, right? I sort of explained that to you. Anybody want to tell me why does a fish chomp on this? Sure, you want to jump in and help anybody? So a fish finds its prey. How does a fish find its prey? Or whatever it's looking for? It's got what in its head? Hey, buddy, you got them too, don't you? They've got eyes, right? So now a fish eyes are located a little bit more on the side of the head than yours, right? Can we talk about that? Or sometimes the water dirty. And so he comes up and he can see probably better underwater than you and I can, but then what else does he use to find what he's after? Anybody else want to know? Yeah, I guess they're tongue-tied, catgut 'em or something. So, especially for bass, you know, the head is sort of separate. My fish is, like I said, my drawing. But they've got what they call a lateral line running through here, right? Remember that? And that lateral line where... I told you I'd show you a fish's ear, and I basically showed you that lateral line, right? Because we couldn't find the ear on the fish otherwise. So in that line... the fish senses, I don't know if we actually know completely, or at least I don't. It's somewhere between hears and feels sound, vibrations. That's why when I take my girls fishing, both my boats are aluminum, of the ones that we go in as a family, but especially the one doesn't have very much insulation, so when they start banging around in there, it makes funny vibrations for the fish to feel, right? And I say, don't do that. I want to catch you. So... I told him a couple things, and I think it might pertain to some things a little bit too similar to me, at least. Is so while a fish does see movement, and to some degree perhaps some colors, the
reason it bites on something, I don't know. I'm quite sure you could go get a couple buckets of pond water out of your river or lake pond and you got water out and check it, and you probably wouldn't find an exact thing like this, or if you did, it would be plastic, right? Do you ever see a creature just exactly like that? So what happens is a fish becomes conditioned to looking for certain things in certain ways, and I told him these twin tails here either serve like to make movement a little bit like a small fish swimming, or like a what we call an Arkansas crawdads, right? And so as the fish comes closer, he actually quits looking, more or less, and he becomes focused on the feel of it. And one thing I found really well in fishing is I really like my tungsten weights, I told him. Lead work, but I would say tungsten outfishes them by quite a bit, and it's because it's denser, and so when it hits the rock, it makes a little bit more of a different clicking sound. Anyways, and so the fish doesn't really close its eyes, but it tunes out, and it becomes, we could say, feeling-oriented, right? And it starts doing, I was trying to tell them, it starts doing what it feels like. And as it probably somewhere, it varies with the fish, but somewhere between 2 to 3 feet, a fish, eyesight becomes secondary. It will use eyesight, and sometimes the far-off vibration can attract it as well, but eyesight becomes secondary as it gets closer and it shifts into feeling mode, I would call it. And it becomes sensation. And so it pinpoints this. It's got these lateral lines running down both sides that can tell exactly where that thing is without having to see it. And even if it's not quite sure what it is, especially talking of like a bass, it'll come up and they don't have fingers, right? That's what I told you. You ever see a fish with fingers? I haven't. Still looking for that one. So it'll come up and it'll pick this up with its mouth to sort of see what it, you know, does it feel right? And that's at the point that if you're really awake and used to fishing, you can hopefully set this hook into them. And in some ways, I'm not too dissimilar than a fish. Do you know that? I like to think I'm fairly objective. But there's times that something attracts my attention, and I get close enough, I quit using spiritual vision anyway. And I sort of start focusing on how it feels. Any of you can all associate with me in that? I close my eyes, so to speak, and I start playing with it. And I would have no intention of getting that hook into myself. I call that, I have a message sometimes that I use this illustration, I call it the hook of sin. I would never want to get hooked. But you know, many as the bass that has bit on a worm like this that probably didn't want to get hooked either. And many as the bass that found himself fighting a losing battle. Thankfully, there's hope for bass, and sometimes there's hope for us even more because we got Christ to help us. But I want you to think about that. Why don't you open your Bibles to Psalm 139? I feel a little bit perhaps vulnerable in some of the what I share tonight. Is not quite sure where to start and stop, and it hooks very much into what I plan to share tomorrow night, sort of foundation. I'm going to try to explain some, well, yeah, at least from man's perspective, very complex things simply, which is always difficulty when you have my brain capacity, so I'll do the best I can and hope I don't lose you in the woods or the swamps too bad. So Psalm 139, I want to just read 1 through 17. I don't know if I'll say a lot about it. I love these verses because, anyway, I hope you love them as well. So Psalm 139, let's stand. Psalm 139. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me, or surrounded me, behind and before, and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit, or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee.
For thou hast possessed my reins. Thou covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in the secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being imperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned as yet there was none of them. How precious also are thy thoughts of me, O God. How great is the sum of them. You may be seated. You know, Joe, with his poor ability, is going to try to explain some things to the best of that ability. But I want to assure you that God knows everything about you. And one thing that's really been, I guess, a comforting thought for me in life is it's comforting for me to go in prayer to God and say, God, you know all about me. I ain't telling you nothing new. I seem to have a problem here sometimes. I seem to have a struggle. I seem to face a temptation. I seem to, whatever it is. I say, you understand this way better than I do. And I've studied some of these things for a couple years. And yet still, God, seems sometimes my knowledge causes me more problems. You know, when it's God, he knows all about you. And he knows, well, last night, what makes you tick. He knows why you're here. He knows why you do what you do. And he also knows why you struggle the way we sometimes struggle. So in thinking of ourselves here tonight, I'm going to say in living with myself and in living with others, I am dealing with a package, right? In that I don't really get to let parts and pieces of me that I don't find convenient littering the landscape, thankfully, probably for other people. You know, it's all here. It's all here in Georgia right now. I left some family in Arkansas. But my problems, my fears, my struggles, my temptations, they all followed me right along to Georgia, and here I am. So here's a package. In thinking of the package, I'd like to maybe split this up a little bit. I did this for you a couple times. We'll just call this the package of me, or you can call it your package. So we have the spiritual part of us. We have what I'm going to call the mental and emotional, or soul. I can put that down here for you if that helps. And we also have the physical or body. And one of the difficult things in facing some things in life is knowing what comes from where, or at least I've found that difficult. And I'm by no means an expert on it, but I'll share a little bit of some things that have helped me, some things I have found fascinating. So I'm actually probably the least tired person here. I should be. I had all day just to get ready for tonight. This is what I'm supposed to do, whereas the rest of you had other things to do, and now you're here trying to survive this. So let's say, though, I would say I'm tired. Is being tired a spiritual thing, a mental and emotional thing, or a physical thing? Anybody want to jump in there and tell me what you think? Physical. Okay. I think I have been mentally, emotionally tired as well, and sometimes that's the worst, very worst kind of tired, in that you go to bed and can't sleep. It's hard to hit that switch, whereas if I'm tired physically, that helps. But yeah, I would say overall, when we say we're tired, we're talking physical, generally speaking. And there may be even a spiritual tiredness sometimes when we face an intense battle, but overall, I'm going to put that into the physical thing. Now, here's what the first thing that I think you know, yet I find fascinating, is if I'm tired, and I've discovered this as probably especially as a parent, hopefully the rest of you parents aren't this way, but if I'm about asleep or have fallen asleep, let's say about 1-2 o'clock in the morning, and as sometimes happens, suddenly I wake up to realize there's a small person or something standing beside my bed and they think they need some attention. I find it a bit difficult to be the quality of dad that I wish I was most of the time. Anybody else know at all what I speak of? a couple smiles around, so I'm guessing I wasn't quite alone in that boat. And so there's, even in physical weariness, there's a mental, emotional aspect to it, right? You follow what I'm saying? Where it becomes harder to respond patiently or whatever. And in that way, it even can become a spiritual thing. If I become impatient and don't apologize, I'm not willing to try to wake up happy in the middle of the night. It actually becomes a spiritual issue, could it not? I don't know. I think fathers' impatience, talking to fathers here, has done more damage to their children than a lot of things. And it's something, looking back, I struggled with as a son. But guess what? I struggle with it as a father, which sort of bugs me because you'd think I should have learned that lesson. But anyway, I call that spillover. Make sense? So we would tend to probably isolate physical weariness, being tired, as a physical thing. And yet, if left unchecked, if it just follows, if I don't deal with it, it becomes something that affects the rest of my being. So I call that spillover, just to keep it simple. Okay, so in the things that my mind deals about, I talked about the mind briefly the other evening. In the things that my mind deals with, I think most of those can be divided into two things, correct? One is facts and the other one is feelings. Is that right? Now, sometimes what gets hairy is when I'm not sure which they are. I can tell you that my mind deals with facts and feelings, but sometimes that gets a little bit gray. So let's do this thing then. If I'm hungry, is that a fact or a feeling? Anybody want to risk that one? Do what? I still didn't quite follow you, I'm sorry. Oh, it depends. Yeah, I got you now. Sorry. Yeah,
depends what kind of hunger you're talking about.
I'm talking about, so I don't like to eat before church, so I actually could probably be hungry right now if I wanted to. So that in that sense.
Butter.
Okay. So we know that if I quit eating and just don't eat anymore, sooner or later, Joe, as you knew him, will cease to exist, right? So that I need to eat is a fact. That I'm hungry is actually a feeling. If I tell you I'm hungry, I'm expressing that I feel something that could use some food. I don't know, maybe that's too basic for you, but that's more or less where I go with it. I need to eat at some point, fact. I'm hungry, at least for me, generally based on a feeling. Yet, it's interesting to me how something as simple or as complex as hunger becomes very complex as we consider spillover, because I've mentioned Esau to you the other night, right? Where he was willing to sell something that was important. I guess it was a spiritual blessing of some sort. Where he was willing to sell it for a pot of soup. So Esau, at least in my understanding, you don't have to agree with me, but it seems to me Esau had spillover in that I would agree that he was physically had a feeling of hunger. Whether he was at the point of death, as he said, I still struggle with that. But I'll let that, just because of the way God felt about it later. But it went over. He did not value the blessing from his father, which you could say is a mental, emotional thing. And it also went into the spiritual realm for Esau, at least reading on later, it would seem that way. So all of us have, I think I'm going to say all of us have feelings and emotions. Some of us don't like to recognize that we do. We do relate to them differently based on hormonal development, personality, training, experience. So, I'll do more a bit later, but two of what I would later give as core feelings are happiness or sadness. Do all people, when they're very happy, act the same way? You've got enough people in this church to know they don't all act the same way, huh? Some act a little different. They do that in Arkansas as well. If they're sad, do they all act the same way? Don't seem to. You know, I've had some pretty deep griefs in my life, and I just want to go away and get away from everybody and just sort of fight it out with God. But some other people, they seem to just love a whole crowd of people around them. And I don't begin to understand in my brain. I can more tolerate people because I'm a Christian than any other reason, or try to be. I just want to get away. And it's fine, you know. I'll give you a sort of interesting illustration. So Evidently, you catch on that I do a bit of fishing. One of the young sisters from our congregation that has worked for me in the past started a courtship with a fellow from Pennsylvania. And so he was visiting the one weekend, and she called me, and she's like, "Hey, would you take us fishing?" And I said, "Sure, we'll go fishing." I better be careful. I don't guess she'll go listen to this message on me here. But let's just say I took them out fishing, and they're probably the couple I love them. God bless them. I hope things go well for them. But they're very different personality-wise, right? So the one hooked a fish. There was no question that the whole boat knew that a fish had been hooked. Of course, we enjoyed hooking fish. That was a good thing. After a while, though, the other one is there, you know, sort of like, we'd gone to that river. That was in Santa Fe. Never mind. I'm getting myself confused. And so I noticed this, the other one that hadn't caught a fish at that point was this reeling in. And he had a good, well, I told you not which one it was. Anyway, he had a good bend in his rod. And she goes, "Hi, you got a fish?" And he's like, "Yeah, I thought I'd see if I could get it in before y'all saw it." So, you know, we got very different personalities in the fishing boat some days, and we probably do in church, and we likely do in the community, and that's all good. No problem with that. And trust me, I'm one of the ones, if I catch a fish, especially a nice one, I sort of proclaim it, so there's no problem with those others that do. Okay, so the different ways that we respond and experience feelings and emotion are a large part of the beauty, the fascination, and the attraction of feelings and emotions. Yet, they're also the very thing that makes this subject so difficult, isn't it? You ever think about that? I mean, I'm so glad that not everybody acts just like me. It's sort of fascinating having some people a little more quiet, some that express things different. And yet, sometimes it leads to misunderstandings and struggles with each other. We may misunderstand and misjudge each other so completely. Okay, moving on a bit here. In physical things, by the way, I don't know if I ever gave you a title. I have this, The Color in Life. Feelings and Emotions is what I titled what I have here. So there's physical things that may cause or contribute to mental, emotional problems. A couple that I'll name real quick are lack of sleep, lack of exercise, hormonal changes, of course, addictions to substance abuse of whatever kind, a sex addiction. Those are all things that, to some degree, you could call at least have a physical aspect to them, but they have huge impacts on the rest of who we are as well, correct? And something like lack of sleep is not a moral issue, so let's start there. Probably every last one of us has lacked sleep at some point in their life, and that's okay if it's for good reason. Now, if you're just being a stupid teenager, that's maybe another thing. I don't know. And I don't say that unkindly, but I've got some teenagers that I deal with. They don't like to go to bed. And I'm like, that's one of the joys of life. What's wrong with you? It's hard to remember those days, but I sort of do. But, you know, lack of sleep. Finally, let's just say that I told you I struggle with patience at times. When I just am chronically tired, it doesn't help me with patience, does it? And it begins to strain relationships with people if I'm not very careful, which is definitely in here. And it begins to have an effect up here as well on the spiritual side. There's some other things that are a lot more complex. But, you know, if I'm letting myself find pleasure in things that God has said are off limits, I'm definitely going to have physical, emotional, and spiritual things. And that brings me to the spiritual thing. There's also spiritual things that cause or contribute to emotional problems, mental and emotional issues. And just to give you an illustration is, do you think, well, I had given you that list, pride, rebellion, bitterness, unbelief, and fear, and negative fear in that sense. You think pride has an effect on your mental state? Of course you do. You either got to be the gorilla around thumping your chest or you don't feel good about yourself, right? Pride is huge. What about the others? Rebellion. Rebellion? Yeah, of course. Very, very much, doesn't it? Bitterness? Lest there be in any of you any evil or a root of bitterness. You know, that's bitterness is crashed more homes than churches. Unbelief, fear. All those have very,
I think we can say they start here, but they sure come into here. And guess what? If you're harboring them, they come down here big time as well. In fact, here's an interesting statistic. I don't know that there's a way to pin this down scientifically. But a doctor that I appreciate very much, that I use some of his material and some of my things, said that somewhere between 66 to 70%, listen, 66 to 70%, two-thirds more or less, of what he treated on the physical level, he felt sure had begun in here. So that's letting about 30% that was actually physical. Think about that. That's a doctor. Flipping that around, there's a large organization. I don't agree with them on a lot of things, so I'm not going to mention their name. They would be a so-called Christian organization that tries to help people with struggles they face. And they would have said 10% of the people that come to them for help have simply physical needs. You see the disproportionate way we try to fix things? We're generally calling things physical when they're not. And very seldom are we calling things spiritual or emotional when they are. Just interest. Okay. So how many ditches does a good road have? I would say two, right? Most of them. So in thinking about that, as in all things, well, let me just say it this way. I think God alone is the creator. The devil can't create anything has been my conclusion. He simply takes what God has made and tries to twist it, to distort it, to turn it to his own purposes. So Satan contorts, distorts, misdirects, and encourages misuse to ruin God's plan for mankind. And so in something that God has made, like me, like you, in the package that God has made us in, the things that God has made so beautifully, the devil wants to twist them up. And when it comes to feelings and emotions, he does a thoroughly good job of that overall. You know, mankind, cultures, usually take the ditches as they relate to this subject, I would say, in that there's the one, some that deny, cover up, try to hide, try to deny that they have emotions. And just a well-known thing, it's not necessarily trying to be negative about this people group, but Native Americans as a whole, especially in the past, the time of the settlers, they took pride in displaying no emotion, right? Just being stoic. In fact, if you could bear pain without flinching or anything, it was a big thing with them. That would be one example. Now, today, the culture we live in, at least in somewhat in this as a nation here, people are using feelings to determine truth, even to the extent that you're the gender you feel like. I mean, talk about mass confusion. That don't even work. I don't know how you even know what another gender feels like, you know? You might have your mixed, you could say my brain's mixed up, but finally, you can't use feelings to determine truth. May I say that again? You can't use feelings to determine truth. So very quickly, what is the difference between a feeling and emotion? I use both. I've been using both. Generally, I'm not saying you have to split hairs the way I do. Generally, when I refer to feelings, I'm talking about those unexpected impressions that wash over you unlooked for and not necessarily desired. We could call them an instinctive impulse that makes you feel good, bad, excited, panicky, sad. In other words, if I would get a phone call that one of my close friends was killed in an accident, I wouldn't have to try to feel sad, right? I would have a feeling of sadness, a grief. It would just be there. Whereas generally, as I use the terms, I would think of emotions are more of a consistent repetition of certain feelings, the cultivation and expectation to feel a certain way when things happen. So just the illustration I use of getting the news of a close friend's passing would be, I guess, a good example of that. To some degree, it's a feeling in that I don't try to create anything. On the other hand, it's an emotion because I do know that passing brings sadness, right? So in that way, that one gets a little complex for me. Let me say it this way. Feelings build emotions. Motions influence and direct feelings. And I'll try to describe that a bit later on. A couple of you are looking tired on me. You want to just all stand for a little bit? It's going to work best if your brain's working tonight. So God made us a brain.
our brains here, and I told you the other evening we have around 86 billion neurons in these, in our heads, so wow, we got a lot, don't we? So in the process, your brain releases chemicals. There's endorphins, dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin. And it releases these chemicals to create pathways in your brain. Remember me talking about the spark plug? That when you do, I rub it up here. If you do it just once, not a very big deal. You do it twice, a little bit more of a path. But if you just do it and do it and do it, you create a big path. So that's what those chemicals really do. We could call them the spark. So when I are experiencing things of life, let's say something as simple as taking a drink of water, feeling a hunger craving, getting good rest or sleep, experiencing pleasure or satisfaction, my brain is forming pathways with these chemicals that remember that, hey, when I feel this way, a drink of water tastes good. So it creates this pathway that I sort of automatically begin doing this. I don't have to have a conscious thought. That's probably why I'm a little addicted to a glass of water, unfortunately, when I'm preaching, is I start feeling like I'm thirsty and my throat does get dry. So without having to spend a lot of thought and getting distracted from my notes, I just reach down and take a sip. You know, make any sense? And so that's because I have created that pathway in my brain. So it suggests an action and doesn't even really take thought. I just know that once what I want. This also happens with things that we could consider negative. For example, when someone has experienced fear, extreme fear, let's say somebody in Ukraine or Gaza right now, somebody's experienced rejection, abuse of some kind, neglect, our brains create pathways that where we begin to associate certain feelings with certain things, and then we have a predictable response for how we want to do this. I don't think I have this later. I'll just give you the illustration now. If you can stay awake, you can sit back down. Years ago, I took a sales class because of the business I'm involved in, and they told us, one thing they told us is be very careful about the deodorant you use. And I was like, oh, that's a little odd. Where are we going with this? And they said, well, they said stick with more natural or very common ones because they said if somebody, for example, let's just say it this way, if I have not run an ethical garage door business and I come around smelling pretty strongly of one kind of thing, and years later you come around and are doing business with the person and you use the same deodorant I do, that person will have a negative impression of you because of you smell like me, even though they won't necessarily stop and think about me at that moment. That's how complex this whole thing can be. I didn't know. I had a phone call. I wasn't necessarily going to dive into this real deep, but I'm going to mention this briefly, is addictions are very much part of this process as well. A lot. Okay, so I know that there's part of addiction is being addicted to a substance. Substance abuse, that's what they call it. And so I know that your body craves it sort of on the physical level, but even mentally, when you have given yourself to... probably some of us are a little addicted to caffeine. Is that okay to talk about that? We won't call that substance abuse, maybe, but we'll call it a crutch. There we go. So let's start with caffeine. In the morning, they actually done research that if you actually want to get the optimum benefit for your physical body out of coffee, you wouldn't drink it first thing in the morning. You would wait till about towards noon somewhere. Just because of the way your cells are and the way coffee affects them and everything, that would be optimum. But guess what? For most heavy coffee drinkers, they need that cup pretty soon after they wake up, whether it's necessarily optimal use or not. And that's because they have created this pathway in their brain that they feel that warm cup of coffee, just the smell of the coffee, just the little high of the caffeine just sort of kicks them in gear where they can go through the day with a little bit of a bigger smile on their face. So, you know, God bless and drink your coffee. Be a good Christian. But now we get into more serious things, pornography. And unfortunately, that's not staying on one side of the house anymore in our churches. I could go on other things like that. When we give ourselves to sinful, shall I say pleasure, because that's part of the sin is pleasure, or we think it is, we actually create pathways where we create an expectation to feel a certain way. And like I told you, it's hollow, so we go back partly because it's empty, but we also go back because we want that. There's a couple seconds of pleasure in sin usually, right? And so we want that high. And the more often you do that, whoever you're struggling with it, I'm not running you down, but get some help. Because the more often you repeat a process of sin, the more firmly you're embedding that thing into yourself. And guess what? For people that have spent years in that, they have actually altered the chemical makeup of their brain to where they're hooked on that thing. And it's very serious. Not only is very much, of course, in the spiritual sense, but even in the emotional and physical. The other thing that's really sad, I'll just point that out right now, is people, a lot of times people that are connecting, let's just say for porn, for example, are connecting emotionally to a picture, become unable to connect emotionally in a good way, at least with other people. They can't even connect right. And it's really sad. It's really sick. It's really awful what the devil's doing, not only in the world, but in our churches. Things are never quite what we want them to be, and yet we keep repeating the process, building that highway stronger and stronger. And you know, I've worked with people. I'll call them my friends. I've got some friends that have spent 15, 20 years in this cycle. And I still want to have faith that God can deliver them, but brothers and sisters, it's hard. It's really, really hard. And you can't, I shouldn't say God can. God can do a miracle. But generally speaking, you cannot quickly fix a deep-rooted issue like that, because those responses become very ingrained. Just like if you take my cup of water, it really stunned me here. Those people feel stunted when they're not getting their high off their sinful pleasure. So a couple things I was going to say real quick on this while I'm at it. First of all, it's way better to never begin a negative process, whatever that is for you. Is it an addiction to fear? Is it an addiction to porn, whatever? Don't start the process. If you found that you have started the process, the sooner you stop, the better. Because guess what? Today is going to be the easiest day to quit. Tomorrow is going to be that much harder, and the day after that, so much harder. So many people say, well, just a little more. Friends, every layer is just that much more that has to be broken. There's another thing that factors in here, and I think I'm correct. Some researchers may not agree 100%, but I think age plays a role. So young people, be highly motivated. Okay, I made lots of mistakes when I was your age, and so I'm not being down on you. But if you find yourself struggling with something, the time to address that in your life is right now. Please do it. Because if you wait 5, 10 years, the chances that you will actually face that and fight that battle just decrease with every day. It becomes so much harder. So much harder. Okay. So the emotion is a complex psychological state, and I'll try to keep this fairly simple, that involves three distinct components. So in building an emotion, I'm talking now not feelings as much, but emotion, you have a subjective experience, something that happens to you, a circumstance or an incident. We'll try to make this interesting in a moment. Second, you have a physiological, so it involves your physical and your logical response. Your physical response to what happens sort of more in the feeling stage is the next thing. And then the third thing is you have a behavior or expressive response, what you thought and planned after the initial voluntary response. So I brought one of my friends here with me tonight. I hope we don't have, I don't want to cause any panic here. I thought maybe he would help me create the incident. I call this friend Herbie. So he's got a lot of use in my office. So if I would introduce you to Herbie. And just in case you're panicking, he's not real. I mean, he's real, but not real. You get it. Okay. So, since he's just a piece of rubber or plastic, I don't know how his headset, but we'll let that. If he'd be real and he could have sort of oozed out from underneath the pulpit and come around, we would have had us a real incident in church tonight. Would you agree with that? I don't know. So, I can just go put him down there. Maybe he's taking too much attention up here. But let's say he sort of had crept out and you would see me preaching. I don't know if you'd love me enough to warn me that a snake is there around about my feet or not. But it would have caused an incident. So that's the first stage, is the incident. So it runs like this. We have the, I don't know. I'm going to run out of space here. Let me just erase this.
We often call that the circumstance, but we have the incident that comes up, whatever that is. And these happen in quick succession. Incident or circumstance that leads to, that leads to what I'm going to call an instinctive response. Sometimes I teach a class in Bible school on this, by the way, in case you're wondering. And I often use the thing of mice there, that if I could just open that door and the whole room was flooded with mice, there's some of them that would be up on the bench. And there's some of them that would shriek. There's some of them that would stomp. And, you know, the incident is the mice, the snake, or the mouse. The first thing that happens when it registers that there's a mouse or a snake around is instinctive response. You don't necessarily premeditate this. It just happens. But now after about, 5 to 10 seconds, people start thinking, right? They start thinking and they become more dedicated in their efforts, whatever that effort would be, whether it's to escape or to exterminate. So somewhere in there, in instinctive, I sometimes do, there's sort of a temperamental response where it's more, temperaments vary, you know, so sometimes that gets involved. But the next one is what I call the conscious reasonable choice. Leads to the conscious reasonable choice response. And that is where we are now thinking and acting according to what we think is best for the situation. And like I said, these all happen very quick. Thing happens. The first, no thought, perhaps a very small glimmer of a time frame between this, where even temperaments can shine out or in that process, then where we go to conscious reasonable choice, to where now we're doing what we do because of who we are and how we feel about this. Okay. So hopefully that's not too much information overload. Emotions are shaped by a logical inheritance. So you got some of your tendencies from your parents. Your cultural experience, that can mean as in a large culture, as in a nation, or it could mean just in your home, to church, school. Our cognitive thought, the way we think, the way we're trained to think, our value system, what we accept as truth, and even our expression and language. Here's something that's really intrigued me, is in thinking about feelings, emotions, people with larger vocabularies actually experience more. And it's because they have more ways to describe it, I guess, and you could argue about that, how which feeds what, but it's sort of interesting. So do you control your feelings and emotions, or do they control you, was one question I had here. Do you have any choice in how you feel and respond? Are your feelings and emotions hardwired to trigger on their own in response to circumstances and events? So to some degree, I would say they are. We have that instinctive response that I've got somebody that's very near and dear to me that... they're a lot of fun to scare because they just have a really good response, let's say it that way. And I don't know if they will ever change. It's not my wife, by the way. I have scared her, but it's somebody else. And it's sort of who they are, and I don't think it reflects anything negative. So you could say to some degree that the feelings are the instinctive one is. Now, I have seen people make dedicated efforts even in those and get them somewhat reprogrammed. But thinking now more especially about emotions, are they something we control? Listen to these verses. I know I sort of jumped around, but Joshua chapter 1 verse 9 says this. God talking to Joshua, "Have I not commanded thee? Be strong and of good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee whithersoever thou goest." So if Joshua had no choice in how he felt about things, why did God suggest that he not be dismayed? Proverbs 29, verse 11 says, "A fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it till afterwards." In other words, I would suggest maybe he's saying it's really quite foolish if we just let ourselves just express anything because we feel like it.
Ecclesiastes 3, verse 4, and I'm just grabbing one out of a whole list of time verses, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance. Again, indicates that we have some choice in this process. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7 says, Paul writing to Timothy says, "For God hath not given us a spirit of fear, but of power, of love, and of a sound mind." And guess what? I think we all want a sound mind, but I think the problem is sometimes we're not willing to invest the hard work in it and to realize that we have more of a choice than what we realize. Sounds to me like God sees a choice in some of these things. Now, here's what I found very interesting, and I don't want to depend on man's philosophy. I do research a fair bit for some. And there's a individual, I don't know. Yeah, I'll just mention the name. I'm not promoting her work or anything. But Lisa Feldman Barrett, she spent 25 years working in one of the primary psychology things. And I could give you the title in Massachusetts. I'm not going to spend time on it. But she says this. Let me just read very briefly from what she writes. She says, "Emotions are not what we think they are. They're not universally expressed and recognized. They're not uncontrollable. They are not hardwired." She goes on and says, "It may feel like your emotions and feelings are hardwired and just trigger on their own in response to circumstances and events, but they do not. You are not born with emotional circuits. In fact, there is no such thing. Emotions are not triggered. You create them. They emerge as a combination of physical properties of your body, a flexible brain that wires itself to whatever environment it develops in, your culture and upbringing which provide the environment." I felt sort of sorry for this lady in that she spent most of her life trying to discover what the Bible had already said. What were the verses I just read? And however. You understand what I'm saying? God has told us we have choice, and those choices add up day after day, either to the good or to the bad. So there's many ways to dissect and explain some of this, and I don't want to keep you all night here. That'd be a quick way just to... I find it interesting and helpful for myself. I'm going to call these core feelings. It's interesting. Nobody can agree how this should be done. So, of course, a hillbilly from Arkansas is not going to get it right. Don't take it that way. Some say there's 8. Some say there's 27. Some use 6. Somebody more recently said 4. And, you know, me being a simple fellow, I like 4. That was just, I could sort of wrap my mind around it. So, here's what they're going to say are the 4 core feelings. I don't know. I'd like to write them in a circle, but I don't have time or talent for that. So we'll let it go. We'll just do 3. 1, 2, 3, 4. I have a circle, and I could print this off if somebody wants it. I usually do a PowerPoint when I'm teaching this, and probably the first time I'm doing it without. But anyway, there's really no certain order to this. But in trying to dissect this, they would say happiness. Let's see here. Got lost. Surprise. Disgust. And sadness are the core ones. So whatever the people that subscribe to this philosophy would say that whatever other things you experience begin with this, or a combination of these 4. So let's say that I just go back. Let's say I would get news right now that one of my friends, close friends, died away. There would be surprise, of course, and there would be sadness, right? And then that would morph into other things. You follow me? And you can make that as complex or as simple as you want. We could keep going. If a snake had slithered out from underneath the pulpit I was talking, there would be surprise and probably for some disgust, correct? Maybe some would have happiness that got interrupted here. I don't know. But you sort of get it. And so that morphs out. Let me grab. I don't have any more scary things here. I just wanted to briefly be able to look at something I had on here to just easier. So in a way, those, the initial feelings you would have, they would generally attribute to happiness, surprise, disgust, or sadness. And then that would go out into more complex, into more your temperament response, whatever, instinctive, where you would have words like maybe somebody's positive, negative, fearful, perfectionist, aloof, sympathetic, frustrated. Anyways, we could keep going. So the next stage,
usually I would have these in circles. So you would have these as the inside circle. The next circle you would have out there. And then the next, which this would be your somewhat more your instinctive area. And then it would go out into your temperamental area.
Or yes, and then into your, where you start thinking about it. You know, natural personal, these
here, you really can't do anything about them. Everybody's going to experience happiness, surprise, disgust, or sadness. It's how you process that as what leads to the result down the road.
And maybe I should have just printed this off late now, so I'll keep going. The natural personal temperament tendencies, which would be what would be the second circle, you experience these. It's not really something that you can totally control in the next area as these morph into different things. And yet, you do need to control the long-term impact. In other words, I was talking about grief, where if a friend died, there would be surprise, there would be sadness, that would morph into grief in this area.
Grief in and of itself is not wrong, is it?
Now, at the same time, if 10 years from now that grief is still controlling me, I need to work on it,
just to keep it simple, and that would then morph into there, into the choice area.
How do I deal with that grief? I and you will be held accountable for amplifying or repressing our natural tendencies. Together, core feelings and natural personal temperament tendencies combine with experience, culture, environment, and conscious choice to form our emotional response to the circumstances and incidents we face. So maybe enough of that. I did have a little pretty neat thing here that I couldn't quite resist. You're going to let me walk the aisle here and show y'all something in a minute. Come on. Okay, what is the purpose? Why did God make us with these things? I mean, what's the benefit? I sort of touched on it a little bit already. They help us communicate and understand each other, a bit more on that. They're a quick and efficient way to relate to the world around us. I'll give you a case in point, and I'm not trying to take any glory to myself, and this wasn't really emotional, but it's more the instinctive part. I drive a lot in my work, and I've often wondered if I saw different scenarios, what would I do? And one was, what if somebody would cross the center line and come at me? Now, to God be the glory, please understand, I think he directed it more than that I had trained myself, number one. But number two, I think my having thought about it and wondered what I would do possibly contributed to one day, one of the young men that I work with and I was driving, we were coming down the road, about 60, 65, and somebody on another road just pulled out right in front of us. I mean, just there was no time to even hardly hit the brakes. And they pulled out, they saw us and stopped, which was the very worst thing they could have did because they totally blocked my lane. And I, like again, I said, I give thanks to God. At the same time, possibly he used forethought in that I'd always decided that if it came to hitting a vehicle or crashing myself in the ditch, I'd take the ditch if I all had a choice. I wouldn't have hardly had time to brake much at all to any effect, but I did have time to whip my steering wheel into the ditch, and thankfully God took me back up onto the road. That's the part that actually was hardest for me to understand, how I ended up back on the road. But you see how it was somewhat instinctive, yet it was also something where I had sort of worked on what would I do. So your brain uses experience, the past, to come up with a plausible explanation for what you're facing and suggests how to feel and respond to it. And without that, God has wired us in such a way that to a lot of things in life, we're not sitting there. It's not like I have to look at a cup of water for a couple seconds to register that's a cup of water to know that that helps my throat when it gets dry. You see, it's a process, and it's a very efficient process, because without that, it'd be very difficult. So they say emotions are a lot like this, and I may have goofed, but I think I'll show this to you. Can anybody tell me what that is? You don't have to say right off. Just take a good look, and I'll try to let everybody have a look and see if anybody can. Maybe you've seen this. So what is it? Okay. Anybody?
Guess? Okay, I'll just show you what it is. Does that work? The reason I goofed is because I had already one up here, so I wasn't sure if you would catch that or not. And then the way that this is like our emotion is that, I don't know how many of you were in doubt before, but if I take it back now, you can still see it. And that's basically what your emotions are doing is, even though we have the same thing as you saw before, maybe we're uncertain, once you have experienced it, now you're certain, even though it's still vague. And your emotions do a lot of the same thing where, even though you may not know exactly what's happening to you, exactly what you're experiencing, but your brain sort of runs through this process, not cognitively, just on its own, and tries to suggest scenarios where it feels like this is what it's like. What is this? So depending on what your experience, if a snake does crawl out from underneath the pulpit, you don't sit there thinking, did this ever happen before? No. At the same time, you are thought unthinkingly, where else did I face a dilemma like this? And what's the right response? What works for me in my situation? And once you want, the more you've experienced, the more you have in that way. Okay. And it's interesting how far this even goes. For example, we're using it all the time. This process helps you understand and anticipate the words I am speaking even before they come out of my... I don't have to finish, do I? You did it for me because you knew exactly what was happening because you've experienced that before. So it fixed it for you. Emotions do the same thing in helping you understand the people around you and in helping them understand you. Yet I'm going to say this whole process is fraught with risk and danger because it's a guessing game of predictions based on your own experience and tendencies. For example, and I had actually started some of these studies as in a marriage, we had some marriage things at our church, and that's sort of where I got started on some of this. So let me just say this. When a wife tells her husband, "You don't understand me," or "You just don't understand," do you know what she's saying? Just any of you? She said, if I was sitting there looking like you, I wouldn't understand. That's what she's saying. She, of course, doesn't know whether you understand or not because she's not you. But if she's telling you, "You just don't understand," it's because for us fellows, we have a sort of a probably unhandy way of tuning out and sort of looking blank when maybe we're not as dumb as we look. I don't know. Maybe you are. And so she's like, "Well, if I looked like you and acted like you, I would not understand me." That's basically what she's saying. You know, if a friend tells you, "You just don't care about how I feel," what they're in reality is saying, if I was responding like you are in this situation, I wouldn't care a bit of how you feel. So we're actually, when we say something like that, we're actually talking about ourselves, not the person that we're directing the words at. I mean, we may have an attitude, but we got that attitude because of how we would be if we were looking like them, basically. Okay. So we interpret each other's feelings, intents, and motives by comparing them to our own, and then we predict why they are responding the way they are based on why we would respond that way. Again, I'd like to tell you that this predicting and guessing may be correct, or it may be incorrect. Let's say another way of saying what I just told you is the emotions you detect in other people, and I'm sort of crunching my own toes in this process, come to think of it. I was going to wonder if my wife was going to catch this one. The emotions you detect in other people are at least coming in part from what is occurring in your own head. Huh? Ever think about that? So when you say somebody else is proud, look out. Not saying they're not, but part of your interpretation of pride comes from your own struggle with pride. Did you know that, right? We could keep going. Rejection is another prime example of this. People often find rejection even where it wasn't intended. And it's because of what they're experiencing in their own head, so they project that onto other people. And, okay. You know, we'll be much more accurate in our prediction, our guess, if I should call it that, if we have experienced what others are experiencing. If we can copy what we see them doing in response.
You see, this maybe grief would be a good illustration. Someone who's experienced grief personally, has lost someone near and dear to them, will often, can I say, almost instinctively know how to relate to somebody else that's experiencing better than someone that has not. I have almost wanted to throw some people out of viewings and stuff already when they sit there and they just, some of the things people in our churches say to other people when they're in grief is, some are being bizarre and cruel, and I know it's not intended, but it's totally thoughtless. And it's very clear they have not experienced it. And so they're just sort of blabbing because I guess they're nervous. And I just want to tell them, just be quiet. The very best thing you can do if you don't know what to say is be quiet. I'll let that. That was maybe too harsh. Here's something really interesting, and I guess bear with me. Maybe I shouldn't have time for interest things like this, but this does intrigue me. Do y'all have a pen or a pencil? You don't have to do it. But did you know they did a test where they made a bunch of people try to say what emotions other people were experiencing. So they did it when they were just like we are now. And then they made all of them take a pen or a pencil and put it in their mouth like this. And then they had to write down what the emotions the other people were experiencing while they held that in their mouth. When they didn't have to hold anything in their mouth, they were about 70-75% accurate. When they had to hold something in their mouth, they dropped to a little bit below 30%. And that's because of something we call mirroring, where whether you like it or not, you know, preachers know this, right, Sim and Daryl, the rest of you? When I sit here, I can tell who's really into what I'm saying because you mirror. You may not look just like Joe, thank God, but you still, they're expressing some emotion or something where I can tell you're with me or not. You know what I'm saying? Whereas if you all sat there with a pen, poor Joe wouldn't know whether he had lost them all in the swamp somewhere or not. And this gets really interesting. I've noticed this. In fact, one of my most embarrassing moments of my life had something to do with this. Have you ever noticed a parent or an older sibling feeding a young child? And I don't have a spoon up here, but they come with the spoon and they go, ah. Yeah? You ever see that? Why did we open our mouth? We didn't want the food, did we? It's because we're trying to get them to mirror us. We want them to do what we're doing. And so here's an embarrassing moment, just so you don't sit here wondering. I had a 19-year-old boy, I think. Is that about right? Had Bible school one year that got extremely sick. And for some special reasons, he sort of fell to my care. And he was so weak, I had put him on IVs. Had him in the hospital, but they were so slow, I decided to take care of him better myself. Had a doctor that helped me with IVs. And anyway, so I was taking care of his IVs and stuff. And at one point, we felt he needed to start eating. And so he was so weak, he literally, I don't know if he actually didn't want to. I don't think, he wasn't that crazy. But he needed fed. And so I was there feeding him. And I so bad wanted this young man to get better. Don't you know? I did wish the concrete floor would have opened up there for a little bit. I felt so stupid, but anyways, it was all right. Good for my humility or my pride, whichever that was. So interestingly enough, taking this just a little bit further, and I'll drop it, is actors, and I'm glad we don't participate in that in our churches, but actors who fill the role of mentally unstable people in like videos and films generally are encouraged or required to take therapy after acting for that role, because if they're a good actor, they actually start becoming that way because they mirror what they're doing and it actually starts affecting them. Here's where this gets even a little stranger, if you will, is that the way you experience your own emotions is through the same process of guessing. So it's one thing to guess yours. It's a little weirder to think that I guess my own, but I do to some extent. So our brain is continually analyzing how you feel and deciding how to suggest a response based on that basis of how we feel. For example, I have done some repairs in the type of work I do. I've gotten to a restaurant and I ate a perfectly great breakfast at, what shall I say, 6:30, 7 o'clock. And 9, 10, I'd go into a barbecue joint or somewhere where they were making good meat, you know. Smelled really good to work on a door. And I literally heard my silly stomach growling one time. I'm like, what's going on here? I fed you real well this morning. But it's my nose smelled it. My head said, well, when he smells stuff like this, generally he wants to be hungry, so belly fire up and let's go. And even though it was totally useless. Another time this may happen is when you're under a lot of pressure, say in a test, or maybe you're taking a driving test or something. You have a hammering heartbeat where your heart just rate really ramps up. And I have this sometimes. And you know, your body will increase your heart rate when you're gearing up for a fight, right? And I'm not talking about a physical fight, hopefully, here. But when you face something really difficult, scary, your heart rate increases. Well, yet some people have programmed themselves to feel that when their heart rate increases, something's wrong, they're stressed, they're preparing for a flight instead of fight because of how their brain tells them to handle this. So you cannot avoid some of these physical reactions and their accompanying emotions, but you can channel them. One thing, for example, is soon after I was ordained, I still get it a little bit, but I actually literally, public speaking, I don't know, I would actually literally get sick, like heartburn. I felt like I was having a heart attack. I'd get cold sweat, just the whole thing. I mean, it almost serious enough that since I'm over it, I can tell my wife now. But I literally thought I was going to keel over one of the days I did that. And as I have learned to channel my nervousness a bit, maybe you're saying he's not doing a good job, and that's fine. But as you channel that nervousness in public speaking, hopefully I can take it more from being a distraction into becoming more passionate about what I'm doing, for example, right? So it's learning how to control and channel those things. Fear can either paralyze or inspire. So use your emotions to further your job rather than having them control you. This thing, for example, that helps me a lot, I guess there's school teachers, other people here, I don't guess your preachers have that problem, but for one thing I've really found helpful, just breathing. Focus on breathing, for instance, a little while before I go up and stuff. It's interesting how things like that help. So here's a question for you. You don't have to reply, but have you ever woken up just at a random time in the middle of the night and you just had this horrible, clammy, dreadful feeling where you just knew that the world as you knew it had collapsed or something bad had happened. You weren't sure what. Is that unique to me? Where just, boom, you're awake and something's terrible. Don't know what. You know, life seems impossible. And you try to sort through what died or who died or what happened. And you know, you can't come up with anything. And finally, when you say you really wake up, you're like, that was odd. Where'd that come from? Basically, it was just a prediction that your body, for whatever reason, had a faster heart rate or something. And so your brain was trying to find a reason for this, and so it made something up. And you actually had to stop and think till you knew that it was false. And here's where it gets difficult. If I can say this, wrapping this up a bit, lost my place here. If you are looking for trouble, in other words, if you're looking for things to be uneasy about, you will find it. But if, even when we wake up at night like that, but if you, in trusting faith, resign those feelings to God's control and get on with your life, you'll be surprised how quickly they fade into nothingness. You know, I would say this is especially true for maybe those who, and my heart goes out to you, but those who have had less than an ideal childhood or early life experiences. Oftentimes I have met and worked with people that feel trapped by their past, by the things dad, mom, others either did to them or maybe failed to do for them. They feel stunted. And probably I've even had some tell me they're not even normal. You know, the joyful thing I would like to tell anybody, if there's anybody like that here tonight, is that that's not true. The reality is you're not trapped. Yet so often these dear people are like a bird with clipped wings who a year ago tried to fly and couldn't, and they just never try again. Let's encourage them to try again. The other problem with emotional issues is that we perhaps become comfortable feeling bad about ourselves. I had mentioned rejection a while ago. While I'm sure nobody who's experienced rejection would say they like to feel rejection, the fact of the matter is that when I've experienced especially intense rejection, I tend to go looking for it. And I find it where none was meant. I could give you illustration after illustration of people that very clearly have done that. Part of the process that's happening here is we begin to identify ourselves by our problem to such an extent that we become afraid of not knowing who we would be without the problem. And friends, I don't know, that's got to be one of the worst kinds of bondage. There's such a powerful connection between what we think and how we end up feeling about ourselves and our relationship. For example, I know some people that were growing up, unfortunately, in a home where they were told they're not worth much, they will never amount to much. It was not true. But they were quite continually reminded that they were quite useless. The danger was not in it becoming true, but the danger was in them believing it and thus making it true. I need to close this. What should be the rule of emotions in life? I'd say quickly, that of a helping servant. Since emotions work in the way they do, it means that I'm responsible for my emotions. You're responsible for your emotions. The thoughts, the feelings, the intents, the actions I allow today are creating the basis for my prediction and therefore the feelings and emotions of tomorrow. So if I'm allowing myself a lot of negative feelings, a lot of negative views, don't be surprised when you wake up tomorrow and in 10 years and have the same ones, because you built, tomorrow is built on what you're doing today, the choices you make. Think of it this way. You are responsible, not because you are to blame for all that you have experienced, but you're responsible because you are the only one who can change your future by making a positive choice today. Friends, I guess I do have a pretty heavy burden on my heart on this. Maybe I could just say it this way. I've seen a lot of people with bitterness in their heart about things others have done to them. And I understand that bitterness as a man. I also struggle with it at times. Some time ago, in working with somebody I loved very much, it hit me that, do you know, when we allow bitterness in our heart towards anyone, we're allowing the person we hate the most to control us the most. The only way to freedom is to release that person from whatever debt they owe you, so to speak, to just give it to God, and then you can be a free person in Christ. So many people go through their whole life trying to use others to help them feel good about themselves. I'm just going to be blunt with you tonight. No one else Christ can help, but no one else can ever make you feel loved, accepted, fulfilled, and happy. It's your choice with God's help, of course. You, with Christ's help, and you alone with his help, hold the key to these emotions, and it comes through the paradoxes, the opposing, seemingly at least in human lingo, the paradox of complete surrender to Christ and a choice to be rather than to feel. So I've got to choose Christ, and then I've got to stand up in the morning and say, God, you know what? I'm going to have a smile on my face. I'm going to serve today, not because of how I feel, but because of you in me, and I choose to do. I hope you don't mind me reading Philippians chapter 4, verse 6 and 7 out of the ESV. I just think the language is just a bit clearer. This is Philippians 4, verse 6 and 7. So listen closely. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and mind in Christ Jesus. Friends, tonight, that verse had special meaning to me some years ago as I struggled intensely with some moral failure in my life as a teenager. And I never forgot when I heard that word, guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus, explained. Is that word guard means like God will set a soldier on guard. That's what it means to actually have somebody standing on guard. And that's what God is doing in my life. The peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts. He's standing at the door. He's controlling what happens. Feelings and emotions make such a cruel and never satisfied or fulfilled master. May they fill a role of servant in your life. Let's stand for prayer.